Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with South Carolina-based veteran trumpeter Charlton Singleton. We caught up with him about his new 2022 CD called Crossroads and a very rich road he's had in jazz. He's a native of Awandaw, South Carolina. He began his musical studies at the age of 3 on the piano. As a performer, he leads his own ensembles that vary in size and style. He's performed all over the world and in many great cities throughout the United States. In addition to performing, he is in demand as a speaker, clinician, composer, and arranger. He's shared the stage or worked with some of the most talented entertainers in the world, like Bobby McFerrin, Jimmy Heath, Slide Hampton, Houston Person, Cyrus Chestnut, and many others. Enjoy this interview.
Hey, thanks for taking a minute. I love Crossroads. It was wonderful. Usually I interview first, but I jumped to it and I profiled you on the show, so it's a great album. Thanks for taking a minute out.
Absolutely.
I guess the big elephant in the room with the world right now has been COVID for the last couple of years. Everything's been turned upside down. Things are hopefully opening up now, getting back to a better place. So my question to you is, how does this release feel to come out right now with the opportunity to play live? And just overall, what does it mean to have a new album out?
Well, anytime that you can put product out or, you know, release anything, that's a win. And especially it's a win with what we've been going through in the last couple of years. Just to jump on your question, the opportunity to be able to present music, you know, is extra special now, being that, you know, we all kind of got it snatched away from us and realized just how important it was for us to be out in front of the crowd and for the crowd to be able to come out and hear live music. So I feel that it's a blessing, you know, to have this new material out and be able to play and express myself in front of live crowds. It's an awesome feeling. It's just extra special nowadays, seeing as what we all went through.
So I know the way I felt when I listened to Crossroads. It's just one of those jazz albums that makes you feel good, which is what jazz should do.
Thank you.
And I'm curious, what are your hopes for the listener when they buy or download this?
Well, when they buy and download, I hope that they hear the care that went into the recording. I hope they check out the expressiveness of these songs. Unless you've chatted with me about it, you know, some of these songs are pretty dated. From my library of songs that I've composed. For example, The Gradual Lean is a song, and Net and Root are songs that I wrote back in the mid-90s. While I haven't really played them as much, it just felt like it was time to try and get them documented. Quentin Baxter, who produced this and played drums on it, and is one of my closest friends and, you know, best friends in the world, he said, "We're just putting everything down, man. Put it all down there. You got to get it down." That was his thing. And I just hope that everybody, when they listen to it, they hear the joy that we have when we play. Once again, circling back, just with everything that's come, you know, that we've all gone through, anything now is just seems to be, you know, icing on top. There's a song on here that I think everybody can feel and connect to.
I like it, man. Putting it all out there, and it paid off for sure. So I speak to a lot of musicians, jazz musicians from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare that I get a cat from South Carolina. Talk to me about growing up in South Carolina and how, I know you started piano at 3, but how did jazz become your focal point?
It was because of my friends, basically. I think it started off with one of my college professors when I was at South Carolina State University, my alma mater. One of my college professors basically just introduced me to so much. I really honestly didn't know a whole lot about jazz until he just took me aside as my trumpet instructor, and he said, you know, "We're going to start listening to some Dizzy Gillespie. we're going to start listening to some Clifford Brown. We're going to start listening to some Harry Sweets Edison, who's my favorite. We're going to start listening to some Clark Terry. We're going to start listening to all, he just named all of these incredible musicians, and it just opened my eyes to a whole world of new music. On top of that, the history of jazz in South Carolina is ridiculous, with folks like Dizzy Gillespie and, you know, people like Eartha Kitt or Cat Anderson, the great trumpet player, you know, Freddie Green, guitarist for, you know, the Basie band. You know, you just, there's a really large pool of great musicians to choose from that you can listen to and you can learn from. So, all of those experiences, along with my musical upbringing in church, definitely played a factor into me choosing this path to go into with regards to jazz.
One of the things that's really big about our development with music and our love for it is what we see live. What was your first live jazz show?
My father dragged me. My first jazz show, I was in the seventh grade. He dragged me to the big concert hall, which is the Gilliard. It was called the Gilliard Municipal Auditorium back then, but it's called the Gilliard Center now. But my father dragged me there in the seventh grade to watch Dizzy Gillespie play. And to say it was nothing short of amazing would be an understatement. So that was my very first one. Ironically, the next sort of really jazz concert that I saw, before I went to South Carolina State, I was a student at Berklee College of Music for a semester. And I think it was the third day of school, and they had already started having recitals and things like that. And in the cafeteria, I watched Roy Hargrove, the late Roy Hargrove, Dwayne Berner on bass, this guy named Pat Loomis on alto, Mark Turner on tenor saxophone, Victor Atkins on piano. It was like a who's who of the school and of the jazz community eventually. But they were all, you know, like 22 years old, 22, 21, 23, something like that, younger. They were, or maybe even 20. They were very young, but man, they were swinging. So that was... those are the two earliest ones that stick out. Seventh grade, you know, I'm kind of a late bloomer, if you will. But seventh grade, watching Dizzy Gillespie just was mind-blowing. And then to be a freshman in college and watch some people that's about my age and swing, you know, off the bandstand like they were swinging that night in a cafeteria at college was just mind-blowing.
So, you know, the one thing that I've noticed is that you really did hop around the instruments quite a bit. You know, you started out on the piano, and then you went to the organ, the violin, the cello, and then finally the trumpet. I'm wondering, how did understanding each of those instruments increase your prowess on the trumpet? How did that collective whole help you as a musician?
There's a different sort of care and sensitivity that you get when you start to learn all of those instruments, because they're so different. I think piano was and still is the base for everything for me. When I started playing the piano at 3 years old, my teacher at the time was sort of grooming me, I think, to be a concert piano player. Just understanding the repertoire and listening to great piano players, not jazz piano players, but, you know, the you know, great piano players of the world and the voicings from these classical pieces, all of that came back full circle when I started to compare those with listening to, you know, folks like, you know, Kenny Barron and Herbie Hancock and, you know, Marcus Roberts as I was growing up and then circling back going through your Thelonious Monks and your Duke Ellingtons and all of those older hierarchy, I call it. And then with playing string instruments later on, that sort of fine-tuned my ears, a little to just different timbres and sounds. The high and beautiful tinniness and resonance of a violin versus that beautiful warm tenor sound of a cello. Now, if I flip those around, I do a lot of work, obviously, with the release of Crossroads. You can hear it with a tenor saxophonist. And so understanding the relationship of the violin and the cello helped me kind of in a Jedi mind trick way, I think. But it helped me when I would write and think of how to, do things with the tenor saxophone. That, along with also studying some of the great, front lines like your Miles and all of the tenor saxophonists that he had, with him, whether it was Coltrane or whether it was Wayne Shorter or even more contemporary like your Wynton Marsalis and his brother Branford or, so all of those instruments and everything that I've ever done really have come into some sort of play in terms of my development. That's no secret at all. It may have not been the plan in the beginning, and I may have not thought of it per se or said, I'm going to listen to that instrument or study that instrument so that it helped me, do it that way. I think nowadays I reflect more and go back and say, that's where I got that from. Yeah, all of those instruments and just being able to experiment and play them definitely had a big influence on being a trumpet player.
And, you've been to quite a few places around the world. How mm-hmm. have you seen different cultures and different ways that people live their lives, different sounds and sights? How's all that enhanced and made you who you are as a musician?
Well, first of all, you can read about it and you can hear people talk about it, but being over in Europe is a very different thing. It's just amazing how attentive they are. It's amazing how even if they have never heard of you before, how they go out and support festivals and things. Not to say that doesn't happen in the United States here, but it's just amazing how those crowds are so large and they are so in it from the first note to the last note, and they applaud you and they appreciate, what you're doing. So experiencing, those crowds, those large crowds and their love has been amazing. We were just overseas over the summer in June and July. We've played in, we were in Sweden and Finland and Germany, Switzerland, Spain, and the crowds over there were just tremendous. It was hot, but it was tremendous. Playing overseas is quite different. It's got a lot of similarities with the love, but it's just a different kind of love, one that's it's almost like being in a symphony show. Everybody's ridiculously quiet, but they're so intensely listening to every note that you play, and when you're done they erupt like no other, and then it's just back to quiet. I've got to listen intent to the next person or whatever. It's fantastic, really.
What do you like the best about being a professional musician? There's a myriad of things that go into this, but ultimately you create. What do you love the best about it?
Entertaining. I'm an entertainer. A lot of people know me as the jazz trumpet player or the jazz singer because I sing on some of my gigs. Some people know me as the guy that is in the cover band that sings all of these, these cover songs. Some people know me as the jazz band leader in front of a big band. Some people, know me as an arranger. Some people know me as the church organist. But all in all, I just go back and say I'm an entertainer. And And I love every second of it, because it's something that I like to do, something that I love to do. And it just goes to that whole, you know, saying of if you really truly love what you do, then it's not work, you know. And it doesn't feel like work. It feels like fun, you know. And I'm very fortunate to be able to make a living and support my family by being an entertainer, being a concert musician. So it's just, it's tremendous.
So the other side of you is that you're been around some really esteemed, you know, musicians over the years, from Bobby McFerrin, Sly Hansen, Houston Person, Jimmy Heath. The list goes on. So my question to you is, what did you learn from the elder statesmen or the legends and luminaries of this craft that you in turn use the younger players in the world?
First thing that jumps out at me is love what you do. When I did a concert and I was the band leader of this big band, we called it the Legends Big Band. And we were celebrating a lot of the music from South Carolina legends like, you know, Dizzy Gillespie and Buddy Johnson and, you know, folks like that and stuff. And we had guest artists. We had Slide Hampton, who wrote a piece for this big band, and we had Jimmy Heath. And just sitting backstage, listening to them talk about when they were growing up and the way that their eyes lit up, you could just tell that they were having fun. Even in their older age at that particular time, they were still out there having fun. They were very serious about what they did, and there's a level of proficiency, of course, because of, you know, who they are and what they've accomplished and everything. But just the joy and excitement that you could see in them before they even played a note was very evident. So when I talk to young musicians, I say that same thing. First of all, love what you do. Get to the point, you know, if you love the process of practicing, if you get to that point, you know, then you just can't imagine the success that you're going to have with that genuine love is there first. So I always lead with that with musicians. I always tell them, if you do run into somebody that's older than you, and if you happen to be fortunate like I was to be in the company of some of those, you know, masterful, you know, jazz musicians that, you know, you can argue are part of the, and I heard Wynton Marsalis use this term, part of the aristocracy of jazz. just sit and listen to them. Listen to them talk. You can get them started on one thing and you wouldn't have to ask another question. They can just go and go and it'll lead on to something else. And that is valuable information. As nonchalant as it could be sometimes, it is so valuable to just listen to them speak. It's just like listening to your grandfather, your grandmother, or something like that. It's just really valuable just to hear them chit-chat, you know, about their experiences and how you can use those experiences on and off the bandstand as a musician. So I always tell younger musicians, you know, to do that a lot, to talk to people, to ask them about their experiences. If you want to be a true musician, you're going to practice. That's just a given. You've got to practice. But some of those other little things, like just conversations with older folks, and hearing about, you know, such and such clubs and going down the rabbit hole after they've given you information about other things, you know, this conversation led to this, led to this, led to this, led to this. That's another part of the education that I urge young musicians to go after.
So let's say you have a dream tonight and you run into the younger version of yourself, you know, maybe in your 20s, and you can give your younger version one piece of advice based on what you've learned throughout all of these years. What would you tell that younger version?
Do it now. I have thought about this so much. There's so many things that I do now that I think I had the ability to do back then. I just was kind of afraid to jump in and try it. You know, I had the tools. I didn't utilize the tools. I don't think I utilized my abilities, you know, as a as an entertainer until maybe about 10 years ago, five to 10 years ago. That's when I said, and I'd been playing for a long time, but about 5 or 10 years, somewhere in that vicinity, one day I just literally was driving a car and I had sort of an epiphany, one of those aha moments where I just said, you know what, I think I'm an entertainer. I'm not a singer in a cover band. I'm not just the trumpet player that, you know, goes up and plays, you know, does this. When I go on stage, I'm more of an entertainer. That's my thing. I am an entertainer. And I wish that I had done all of these things and taken advantage of it when I was younger, and that I had seen the potential a lot earlier. So, big Charlton, talking to younger Charlton, do it now. That's the thing.
So as someone that's been on a lot of stages as an entertainer, you know, we're getting back to it. We've been away from the stage for a while. What do you hope we all collectively realize about the power of live music now that we're getting back to it?
Oh, that we continue to support, that we continue to advocate for it, that we continue to seek it out, that we continue to like I said, support it, not just by going there, but in every aspect of the word. I think everybody fully understood, you know, just how it was important to their being, to their soul, in order to, you know, experience live music. We did a show shortly after a lot of the restrictions of going to concerts and congregating, you know, were lifted and stuff like that. And I remember walking out on the stage, and there was a crowd of people out there, and they were applauding, and I just sat there and listened to them applaud, and they applauded for like 2 minutes, which is a good long time, you know. And I just walked over, you know, walked up to the mic, and I just said, wow, we have people in here. You could just feel the energy of just all of us in there anticipating, you know, the band anticipating the crowd anticipating the band. And it was just like, yes, please, I needed this. Thank you for having this back. I needed this. So, it's hard almost to put into words just that feeling when you get back out there, or when we have been getting back out there and being in front of the crowd and feeling that love even more so than before. It's been amazing.
So everyone has a perception of you. Everyone, your family, your friends, your fans, your students, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of who you are. So who do you think you are?
I am an entertainer that stands up on the stage and does his best in order to make sure that people feel as good, and if not better, than when they walked in the building. That's my thing. That's my job. And I'm trying to make sure that everybody in that audience is going to have a good feeling to take away when they walk away. You can't please everybody all the time. You can please everybody some of the time, I think. That's my mantra. You know, I heard Sammy Davis Jr. one time, and I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said something like, you know, you don't have to like me as a person. You don't have to like the song that I chose, you know, or the way that I presented it, but you cannot say that I did not go out there and give it my all in front of you. That you cannot say. So that's how I always attack it when I'm on stage. Whether it's a song that I play or sing, or how I set the song up, or a joke I might tell or something like that, I am always trying to make sure that I get the audience involved, you know, with it emotionally, something that they can relate to. That's very important to me. And I think that sort of brand of entertainment is what I do best. So I always strive for that.
Charlton, thank you for opening up, man. Thanks for talking about Crossroads, your life in jazz. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks for listening and tuning into another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in South Carolina, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Charlton for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.